Support for Politics and Public Policy reporting on SDPB is made possible by SDN Communications, your business broadband provider. Learn more at sdncommunications.com.
Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. As the world poises to hear from President Donald Trump about whether or not he will pull America out of the Iran nuclear accord, we broaden our view of the map by welcoming former U.S. Senator Larry Pressler to In the Moment. His 2017 book, Neighbors in Arms, is part memoir, part history lesson, part sounding call for nuclear disarmament. The book takes readers behind the scenes during the years of the Pressler Amendment and the debate over what to do about Pakistan's quest for nuclear arms. And Senator Pressler joins us now from Washington on the phone. Senator Pressler, welcome back to In the Moment.
Well, thank you very much. And my book was part biographical memories, including a chapter about my time at the University of South Dakota back in the early 1960s. Also, yes. So there's a personal aspect to it also, in addition to the nuclear aspect, which with both South Korea and Iran has become very much a discussed topic in Washington, D.C.
Exactly. And let's go back before we get to some of those nuclear conversations. Let's talk about the personal memories a little bit. And take me back to your childhood, because this is sort of when part of your opinion about nuclear weapons is formed, because it's very much part of growing up with the drills and the national news back then.
Yes. In South Dakota, back in the 1950s, in growing up, we had nuclear weapons drills in school at Humboldt, South Dakota, believe it or not, in which we would go into outside. We had a sort of a basement area and a tunnel area out there near the school. But each school had some kind of evacuation plan, believe it or not. In the 1950s, we were scared of the Russians shooting nuclear weapons at us. It never happened. But and I kind of go into that flavor because we've forgotten how involved. And South Dakota had several silos with nuclear weapons, out, especially in the western part of the state. And so South Dakota was considered a prime target for some incoming missiles if they happened. So and I grew up on a farm in South Dakota. Part of my purpose in writing the book was to encourage young people from South Dakota to run for office. We have the women's movement now, the Me Too movement. And I'm glad to see that more women and young men are actually becoming candidates for office. It's a very brutal process. But South Dakota is still a state that a person of lower income or middle income can run for office, certainly for county commissioner, state senator, or even the U.S. House, if they're willing to go out and really work. Of course, that's hard to do because you got to do your job, usually. But a person of middle income can successfully run for office in South Dakota because the costs are still a little bit lower. At least they were in 1974 when I first ran. So I wanted to tell people that you can grow up on a farm in South Dakota, go to the University of South Dakota, or not go to a university, and become a candidate for office. And I hope more of our young people consider that. It's hard for it to make it work with a lot of career patterns. But I'm glad that we have more people running as Republicans, Democrats, or independents than ever before, and we need more, because at the end of the day in our democracy, decisions are made by elected representatives, and we have a lot of boards and we have a lot of appointments in the federal government or state, but the way our democracy is set up, the basic decisions are supposed to be made by elected officials. And I guess that's part of my message, is I want to see young people consider running, and you probably will be forced to run for office almost for the school board or for the county commission or something like that in your careers as you have children and be involved. But I want more of them to consider the elected route.
Right. And you spend a fair amount of time in the book really talking about the independence. Maybe you talk about, you know, being an independent, you know, of party affiliation, but also just an independence of thought and an independence of action. Talk a little bit about the role of people who are elected and really thinking for themselves and how hard that has become in our modern political climate.
Yes, well, I've come to have mixed feelings about that. The way our system works, not constitutionally, but we like to work through two parties, Republican and Democrat. That's not really provided for in the Constitution, but that's the way it has worked out. So normally, one should join the party that they least dislike. some people say they don't like either party, but we do need strong parties the way our system works, not the way it was created, but the way it's worked out by tradition. However, most people like to think of themselves as independent, and we should have provision for people to be able to run as independents without the parties usually set up obstruction to that. But I ran for the Senate the last time as an independent, and I was not elected. I lost. And I've come to believe that, realistically, you probably have to be a member, join one party or the other, and work in it over the years and try to improve it. That's another argument. But citizens need to be involved. They need to be involved in supporting other candidates or running themselves. And more people are thinking of themselves as independents, so in the future, it may very well be that we will see more independents. Now, some people say that Donald Trump basically ran as an independent inside the Republican Party. Well, he certainly made some changes and got everybody thinking, whatever you think about Donald Trump, he's got more people involved in politics than were before. So to me, that's good. I hope people who are opposed to him will oppose him in the electoral arena. I tend to think that rather than trying to impeach Donald Trump, they should be making plans to defeat him if they're opposed to him in the normal election process. So that's my problem with all this news we get. We don't get enough news about real issues, but it's all about trying to impeach Donald Trump. And he's not going to be impeached, I don't think, but I think it would be more constructive for them to get a candidate and issues and say we're going to win the next election, and we're working on it every day right now.
The news about President Trump today is largely that he's expected this afternoon to announce what America will do with the Iran nuclear accord. And when you hear this conversation about Iran and North Korea and nuclear weapons, this is something that you have experience with, laid out in the book Neighbors in Arms. And we'll get into the history in just a minute. But I'm wondering if you could give us your thoughts on how you watch today's news as some of these conversations about the Iran nuclear deal take place.
Yes.
And unfold.
Well, I'm 76 years old now in my 77th year, but my political thinking is still changing a little bit. I did not vote for Donald Trump, but I've come to believe that he did an amazingly good job regarding North Korea in getting these talks started with the leader of North Korea. And he sent, Pompeo, the CIA director at the time, over there and had a secret meeting with the leader of North Korea. It was almost like when Kissinger went to China secretly for President Nixon. So I give Donald Trump a lot of credit for moving North Korea from a position of they're going to be belligerent to trying to be friendly with South Korea. And being willing to meet with, and Donald Trump is taking a risk in meeting with him because the whole thing could blow up. But I applaud the president for that foreign policy initiative. Now, I don't know how he's going to come out, obviously, at this moment on Iran. But I think that perhaps what the result will be some changes in the Iran agreement, perhaps. Whether or not he and Mr. Pompeo have figured out what those changes might be, I don't know. But the president is doing pretty well in foreign policy, contrary to the New York Times. So I say that I'm growing more and more confident in him.
Do you think that some of the criticism he has faced about the way he dealt with Kim Jong-un on Twitter and the insults and the barbs that went back and forth, was that criticism fair? Or do you think that criticism was unfair as we continue to watch? Was that part of his foreign policy strategically?
Yes, I think it was in retrospect. And I was one of those who have been somewhat critical of his tweets and his style. But at the end of the day, he seems to land on his feet pretty squarely. And but that may be part of his negotiating style, is to be rather cross with his opponent at first. And then with Kim Jong-un has certainly changed as a result of something. And he's now ready to meet with the South Koreans, and he's ready to meet with President Trump. So apparently it worked. Well, the point I'm making is that I think we have to look at the results, and the results of the Trump administration have been quite positive in foreign policy. Now, he's got the thing on tariffs that may hurt farmers, but the farmers have a farm bill which has insurance in it, which they will still get a good market price for their subsidized market price for their crops. And I think that he will renegotiate some new treaties out there in the Pacific and elsewhere. So I've come to, although I did not vote for the man, I've come to have a more positive impression of his real results.
Let's talk about the book a little bit and some of the history in it. And take us back to the Pressler Amendment and give us a little history lesson of how that came about and what it was intending to do.
Yes. When I got to the United States Senate, I was assigned to the Commerce Committee and the Foreign Relations Committee by Howard Baker. And those are two good committee assignments. The Commerce Committee is mostly working on transportation and highways and airports and business. And the Foreign Relations Committee is working on the Foreign Aid Assistance Act and other matters and treaties in the foreign relations area. People warned me that the Foreign Relations Committee is kind of a political death trap, because you can't really make votes out of it. People will vote against you if you vote for foreign aid and so forth. But I felt that South Dakota exported about 70% of our product in terms of food exports and machinery exports and other type of exports that are produced in South Dakota. We don't usually think of South Dakota as being an international exporting state, but it is. And so I thought I could do the farmers and small businessmen of the state good on the Foreign Relations Committee, and I did. But a lot of it is you get involved in controversial issues such as nuclear weapons. I became chairman of the Arms Control Subcommittee quite by accident, because Senator Jesse Helms wanted it and Senator Charles Percy wanted it, and they got into a stalemate, one very conservative and one moderate liberal. And the caucus finally gave it to me to settle it. And so I got that major assignment a little earlier than I normally would have. But I went to work on it and had hearings and so forth. But I found that we were doing a very crazy thing with Pakistan. We were supplying them with aid mm-hmm. that they were using to build a nuclear bomb with. So the Americans were building a nuclear bomb indirectly in Pakistan. So I sponsored an amendment that said that our aid to Pakistan would be cut off if we felt they were developing a nuclear bomb. And that is what happened. And George H.W. Bush enforced the Pressler Amendment. So aid was cut off to Pakistan for a few years, and it slowed down their nuclear program. But when Bill Clinton became president, for some reason, and it was money, I think, because there's so much PAC money and so forth devoted by the what I call the octopus, that is the military industrial state, that was in favor of selling arms to Pakistan. And so it was washed out by President Clinton, largely administratively. But that was an effort that drew a lot of international attention, and it's used as a model today for working with North Korea and for working with Iran. And it did work for a time, but then we just didn't, Bill Clinton didn't enforce it anymore. And it was felt that that was because he was getting ready to collect a lot of money for his foundation, which he did, from the arms companies. And so my amendment was effective for several years, then not so much. But the reason I write about it is to talk about the difficulty of being involved in foreign relations for from the United States Senate, because there really isn't a constituency that supports what happens in nuclear arms. They're much, it's the money that the wages people earn and so forth that people vote primarily in connection with. So some people thought I was spending time on foreign relations that I should have been spending on South Dakota. But I argued that I was spending it on South Dakota's behalf. So anyway, it's a story of the struggle of a small state senator being involved in foreign relations.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. My guest is former Senator Larry Pressler. We're talking about his life and his book, Neighbors in Arms. Senator Pressler, we need to take a quick break. If you'll hang on with us, we'll come back and have more of this conversation. Stay in the moment on listener-supported SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're talking today with Larry Pressler, former senator from South Dakota and author of the book Neighbors in Arms. And Senator Pressler, I'd like to go back to something that you said about the octopus, because this is a sort of a metaphor that you use to explain the current military-industrial complex. And that term came from President Eisenhower, right?
Yes. In Washington, D.C., the arms companies and their law firms and consultant firms are so powerful. And the way they do it is not always by giving money, but by filing motions all around town with sophisticated law firms. Mm-hmm. For example, Senator John Glenn and I, we had an amendment to prevent Pakistan from receiving any nuclear materials from the United States. But their lawyers went over to the Department of Commerce and got a certificate that essentially released certain nuclear materials to Pakistan. And that was from a different agency. We anticipated it was the Department of Defense, or the Department of State. So they're just tireless. They have all these lobbyists around town. And they also give a lot of money. So they're a tireless group, but I call them the octopus. They're all over, the arms lobbyists. And they sell huge amounts of arms overseas. And a lot of people say it's for our national defense, but it really isn't, because a lot of them are duplicative systems, and the taxpayers end up paying for all this. And so I tried to, but it was a great mistake, because in my 96 race, all those arms companies in the background, once or twice disguised, removed, were against me, and I was defeated in 1996, running for a fourth term in the Senate, primarily because of things I had done on the Pressler Amendment and the not having the backing of those arms companies, or having their active opposition. And that's tough. That's tough going, because the average citizen doesn't understand what's going on, and they really don't say what they're for. They'll run ads saying that Larry Pressler is not for a strong national defense and stuff like that, without being specific.
Talk about going to India, and because much of this book is written with that relationship between the United States and India in mind.
Yes, the Pressler Amendment was thought to favor India, although because the Pakistanis feel that their main threat is from India, but India is no threat, because it's a democracy with a free press, and they're just like we are in terms of human rights and so forth. The Pakistanis are not. They're a military dictatorship, and they have lied to our government several times and lied to me several times. Originally, Pakistan supported the Peshawar Amendment because it restored aid. Jimmy Carter had cut off aid. This is all ancient history. But long story short, India was thought to be the beneficiary of it, but then it wasn't enforced. And India is the excuse. India is a great country, and we should, I advocate in my book that we should make them our number one ally after England and some of the European countries, because India is a democracy. It has a free press. It has courts and values. It has a lot of problems. It's got 1 billion people, and we need them as our ally. We're synergistic with them. We have products we can sell to them, and they have products they can sell to us. Now, right now, the main thing that's happening is, again, an arms sale agreement. President Obama, when he went to India, he mainly set up a whole bunch of arms sales, had two plane loads full of arms company executives with him, and our main relationship with India now is selling them arms. And for that impoverished country to have to buy all these arms and nuclear weapons and so forth. But anyway, the military-industrial state has come to be a way of life in Washington, D.C. And we are, you don't like to say it, we are a military-industrial state. We're sort of like one of the ancient Greek states that was mainly Spartan and military and so forth. We have become that in terms of our public expenditures. And it's very hard on the average taxpayer. The American people are a very heavily taxed people. And it's because of all this arms spending we do around the world. We send troops everywhere. We shouldn't do that. I'm a Vietnam veteran. I describe that in my book. And I am opposed to us believing. But it seems as though that everybody who runs for office nowadays is for more military spending. But that's a result of the octopus, the military-industrial octopus, giving money in campaigns and so forth. And I'm sick about it because it's a misuse of our country.
Hmm. What do you think the average voter, the average citizen can begin to do in learning about, because certainly when then President Obama, you know, traveled to India, it didn't seem as if he had just, you know, a bunch of weapons in the plane with him. It seemed like there was a lot more going on. And I'm wondering how you think American citizens should pay attention to the role of the military in our foreign policy.
Right. It's also, they hire very sophisticated public relations firms, and the media has not been completely active. For example, you mentioned President Obama. People wouldn't have that impression, but his trip to India was an arms sale trip, as every president's sales will be at this time. So that is something that we have to think about very carefully. And our whole culture in Washington, D.C. is a military-industrial state. This is very, I'm very sad about this, that being 76 years old at the end of my career, it has gotten much worse during my time here. I tried to reverse it, but I got defeated mainly as a result of my efforts to reverse it. The Peshawar Amendment caused me a lot of political problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but again, about regular citizens, because it's hard to, you do hear a lot that the military spending needs to be increased for national defense or for cybersecurity or, you know, contemporary problems in the world. What are those questions that voters should be asking themselves instead of just wringing their hands?
We do have threats to our national security, cyber, and there's a certain level of military spending that's necessary. But in my book, I argued that they have taken over, the military-industrial state has taken over Washington, D.C., and I'm a veteran. I'm a Vietnam veteran, and I saw this firsthand. The whole Vietnam War was fought because our Pentagon wanted to fight it. Pakistan got nuclear weapons because our Pentagon wanted them to have nuclear weapons. And the Pentagon is too powerful, and the State Department should be more powerful. It's just very frustrating to me at the end of my career that things worked out this way. And maybe I'm partially guilty, although, I mean, I always voted for the defense authorization bill, but, well, once or twice I didn't. But it was just so hard. I would offer amendments to lessen it a little bit and so forth, and we just were not successful. And finally, the Pressler Amendment was wiped out by the Brown Amendment, and that was strictly lobbyists from the military-industrial state. So I tried and tried, but I did not succeed.
Hmm. You have regrets?
No, I fought the good fight, and somewhere St. Paul says you got to fight the good fight, and then you're entitled to a little retirement and happy death.
But, not yet. Let's hope. You can have the happy retirement,
but I'm very frustrated with my career. I'm very frustrated that I couldn't do more.
Mm. You were not in Congress, not in Washington, when you sort of had to watch the Pressler Amendment be undone. What was that like for you? And then let's talk about what you see your role now as.
Well, I'm an active member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and I've been called in by the White House for advice on Iran and North Korea and Pakistan. My book has been circulated to the team. I'm very flattered to say that my book has been circulated amongst the president's national security team and amongst the State Department. I think they've got about 40 or 50 copies of it that they have distributed to policymakers. And I do recommend in there that President Trump declare Pakistan a terrorist state, and he has come close to doing that and may do that as his next project. That's one worry I have about the president. He can't be a one-man show in foreign policy. He's got to build a team of trusted advisors and stick with, and all this firing and churning around is not productive, in my opinion. But on the other hand, he seems to have kind of a genius for this success, as is exemplified in the North Korean matter. And maybe his approach is a little different, but if it works, I'm willing to accept him.
We continue to watch that unfold. And again, President Trump is set to address the nation and make some announcements about the U.S. and the Iran nuclear accord this afternoon. Larry Pressler, thank you so much for being here with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. And I have a long tradition with public radio in South Dakota. I've been a contributor either there or here every year. Since I was down there at the university, I gave $25 in 1917. It's in your records down there somewhere.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much.
We on that, and we dug it out.
We look
so
forward to.
I appreciate public radio, and you do a good job, and you give some rays of hope. But I noticed that the public radio is getting a lot of advertisers or whatever by military companies, or once we moved, law firms for them, and they're starting to take over public radio too. So I hope it doesn't influence you too much.
I wouldn't say that there's a risk there for us here at South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Larry Pressler, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.